Okay, we're moving now to agenda paper number five. And amazingly, we are almost back on schedule. Kashi?
Yes. Okay, agenda paper five deals with an ongoing issue initially discussed by the Interpretations Committee in September. The issue is whether the long-term interests that form part of the net investment should be measured applying IAS 28, IFRS 9, or a combination of both. At the September meeting, the Interpretations Committee noted that the feedback received from the outreach had revealed divergent views on this issue, and also noted that the interaction between the requirements of IAS 28 and IFRS 9 was not clear. At that meeting, there was a general support for view D, under which the long-term interests are accounted for applying IFRS 9, excluding the impairment, and instead they are subject to loss allocation and impairment under IAS 28. We understand that such a support was based on what the current standards say, and also we understand that any amendment in line with that view is conditional on whether the interaction between the requirements in IAS 28 and IFRS 9 would work. So for this meeting, we first considered how the interaction and the view D would work. Even though we came up with one possible solution to the interaction issue, as presented in paragraphs 18 to 20 of the agenda paper, we noted that the long-term interest would still be measured with a mix of standards and not consistently with any of the standards. And we thought that any amendment should not be limited to just a clarification or an interpretation of what standards currently say if any issue remains with such an amendment. Consequently, we considered whether there was a better way to address the issue. And as we did further analysis, we thought it is important to clarify the issue before IFRS 9 becomes effective, which would suggest that a narrow scope amendment would be a better way to do than the equity method of accounting research project. And we noted that such a narrow scope amendment should not consider possible changes to the composition of the net investment because such changes are too broad for such a narrow scope amendment. We also thought that the IFRS 9 impairment requirements should apply to these long-term interests. And based on these considerations, our recommended alternative view now would be consistent with view B. And more specifically, under this alternative view, entities would first account for the long-term interest applying IFRS 9, including the impairment requirements. Then they would bring the carrying amount of those long-term interests in the amount of the net investment and do the loss allocation and impairment testing under IAS 28. And if they allocate any loss or impairment to this long-term interest, they would treat them as an allowance. In other words, when they subsequently calculate interest income on this long-term interest, they do not consider any allocation of losses or impairments that are recognized under IAS 28. This way, we thought that the entities could keep the IFRS 9 requirements intact, which we thought was a better alternative than view D. And because there could be situations in which the long-term interest in the net investment could be classified as other than amortized cost, we also recommend that the Interpretations Committee should assess whether an amendment, if any, should cover financial instruments other than those measured at amortized cost. So the questions to the Interpretations Committee are, do you agree with the staff recommendation that the Interpretations Committee should pursue an amendment in line with the alternative view? And do you also agree with the staff recommendation that the Interpretations Committee should assess whether an amendment should consider financial instruments other than the amortized cost?
Michael, did you want to jump in on this? Or
no. Comments? Bob?
I'm a lot happier with this model than the one we previously discussed. So this is more the view B than view D. I always thought we should be applying IFRS 9 to these, and I would apply that first. So I'm happy we're pursuing this, and I would do it as an amendment to 28. I think, though, there's a bit more work that needs to be done in treating this as a valuation allowance, which is I haven't seen people do in the past. I think there's some complications that would have to be resolved. I know many times, well, we say, you know, these loans are, you know, not payable in the foreseeable future a lot, but sometimes they do get paid. Partially paid, fully paid. What happens in those cases to the valuation allowance? If I apply the IFRS 9 impairment model first and that valuation allowance increases so that the difference now, and that the valuation allowance I had adding those losses now causes that whole thing to become credit balance negative. Do I then reverse some of the IAS 28 allowance? I think there's some issues that we're going to have to work through.
John?
I'm not supportive of the recommendation to use the View B model. In my experience, many of these long-term interests are actually in the nature of quasi-equity, even though they might be long-term interests. They're actually, and the investor, whether they put it in by way of ordinary shares and equity instruments, or whether they put it in by some term, long-term receivable, is usually not driven by whether they want exposure to credit risk or equity risk. It's actually driven by tax consequences or ways of structuring the investment. So I think the application of IFRS 9 expected credit loss model to these is not necessary, so I would have gone with UD, where you just apply the IAS 28 impairment. Other than that, I'm in agreement with the rest of the recommendations by the staff.
Bruce?
Thanks. I actually agreed with the staff recommendation. I guess some of my concerns were pretty much in the same as Bob's concerns, in that the use of the valuation, how would you do that? And I guess one of the things that came out to me was also just being conscious that people don't end up double accounting, so that you're not taking a loss. You're taking an impairment, then you're going to IAS 28, you're also seeing that, and I'm just worried that we're starting with a loop where, before you know it, people have written everything down continually on the same set of facts. But I think if we could get the treatment out around exactly how you use that valuation allowance, I quite liked it. I do accept a lot of what John says, and maybe just as a caveat to that, probably outside the scope of this, but just a comment I'll make, that I think a lot of these are quasi-equity, and I think that one of the greater challenges, not for us to pick up now, is whether the accounting for these as liabilities in the first place is correct. But I accept that's probably outside the scope of what we're doing.
Pei Long?
I share the same concern with the Bruce, that just wonder if there are any issues of double accounting. Have you any analysis on that?
It's not so much double counting, is it? It's just you might wind up writing it down more quickly than otherwise.
But yeah, and potentially the interactions, double interactions that Bob was talking about in terms of increases, decreases under one model versus the other model, and how they interact.
Sandy?
I guess I would agree with what's been said, but you know, when I go back to, we have the equity method investee and we have the other item, and we've assumed that they add up to the net investment and that this loss goes against that, or that there should be, but I never was convinced last time that what were the contractual rights to absorb losses in this particular financial instrument, right? We say it's like equity, but contractually, is it equity? I mean, what's my responsibility for the absorption of losses? And we've got equity and we've got this other instrument, but we never talk about, well, is there some loss absorbing layer between that? We've just assumed that I take this loss and I apply it to that, but that's not necessarily how the contractual instrument may actually work. So I understand that that's what the standard says, but I still step back and say, do I have to take that, or is that just the accounting we've decided on? So I have that question first, and then we come, and I guess I'm not supportive of the decision because I don't know really what it tells me. It tells me write off the equity, calculate the impairment under IFRS 9, take this other thing and put it in impairment. So we're looking for a place for a credit. We're going to hang it up on the balance sheet against the asset. But what does this tell me? And I think really what the interesting question is when you get into the discussion of should you apply this to fair value, because that's when you're going to answer the question about the contractual right to absorb the losses, because the fair value is going to assess that. So to me, you know, what an investor is going to do is they're going to say, and they're not going to get it, but what they really want is what's the fair value of each of these instruments? And this accounting stuff is, I mean, what we're hearing about IFRS 9 is that people are just going to take the impairment, same with the CECL model, and reverse it and come up with their own estimate, right, which is always what happens, right? So it feels like, what are we creating? What number? How does this help me? What does it tell me about this asset? I don't know. I mean, to me, the super interesting question here is, if you applied this, I mean, and in substance on this IFRS 9 asset, you're going to have the fair value. So if you looked at the impairment model and you added this number to it, if that number was lower than the fair value that you disclosed, there's something wrong, right? And that's really what an investor is going to do because, but they're not actually going to see that slice because it's going to be buried with something else. So to me, I just don't know what it's actually telling me this thing is actually worth, other than the fact that I've got an accounting problem that says I got these impairment methods and they sort of, you know, got to cross over because IAS 28 says that they got to cross over, so I need to do something, but they don't really tell me what anything is worth. So I'm sort of like, I'd rather have the fair value of the equity instrument and then I just replace both of them because I'd have the IFRS 9 fair value. I know I'm not going to get that, but just as an FYI on how people would actually use the number.
Young Soo.
So many things to say. First of all, I like the step approach in applying the IFRS 9 first and then IAS 28. I think that the long-term interest is basically the financial instrument, so that IFRS 9 must be applied first. For that, I agree. But I'm not sure applying both IFRS 9 and IAS 29 is a good idea or not. I'm not really sure about that. What I see here is three types of different impairment. The first one is the impairment loss from the IFRS 9. The second one is the additional losses of the associates from IAS 28. And the third one is the impairment loss from the IAS 36 that comes from 28. So we are talking about three different impairment losses, and we are talking about combination of these three. So, you know, I don't know what those combinations, the numbers from those combinations really mean. I don't know what those means are. I mean, actually, you know, as Sandra says, if you're talking about fair value, it's going to be easy. But what I see is that none of these three different types of impairment really tells us the fair value at all. The IFRS 9, it's using, you know, the initial discount rate when they discount the future cash flow. That doesn't come up with the fair value. IAS 36 is the same. They're using the current, the discount rate, but they're using the not the expected loss model, but the, you know, the incurred loss model. So they do not really come up with the real cash flow of the financial instrument either. And also, if we take into the additional losses from the associate, as stated in the IAS 28, and if we recognize it in addition to the impairment loss from the IFRS 9, I really don't know what that number really means. So that in terms of the information usefulness, I do not know whether the combination of IFRS 9 and 28 really come up with something useful for the information users. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, none of them are the fair value. None of them will give them any kind of good, you know, the useful information to users if they are combined together. So that is the problem I have right now.
Sue?
I mean, I think Sandy and Young Soo both raised valid issues, but I think one of the things that the staff asked the board when we talked about it individually with them was whether or not we thought timing-wise this made sense, because I think you're asking more fundamental questions about what information content you get out of the equity method approach in IAS 28. This sort of just highlights it more because of the layering that would result.
Well,
and one question was whether it's right to do it now or to wait until we do the broader sort of review of what the information is that comes out of IAS 28. And I think the board, in the meeting that I was at, we felt that there seemed to be a need to do something more urgently than maybe the timing of the IAS 28 project would allow. But, you know, an open question was the timing.
But, you know, I gave that some thought, you know, because I was like, I know this whole conversation about equity method, and that could take us on a whole different conversation, but the real issue is that I've taken a decision that I need to aggregate these together.
That's already in 28.
I agree, and I don't, that, no. To me, that's where my hang-up is in its premise, because, okay, I have an equity method investment, and I have this other thing, and I've made an assumption in IAS 28 that if I've used this up, I've got to go over here. But contractually, that may not be how it works, right?
But I
don't necessarily think that makes me want to revisit equity method. It makes me want to revisit the notion of bringing these two together, because they're separate instruments with separate cash flows. And when an investor is going to look at them, they're going to look at all these other layers in the waterfall.
Andrew?
Yeah, I think longer term there are some issues for the equity method research project to be addressed, but I do think shorter term we need a solution. The key question is, do we or do we not apply the IFRS 9 expected loss model? That's the big change in the landscape, moving from IAS 39 to IFRS 9. I don't quite see the benefits of applying two impairment models. I don't really see that piece of the jigsaw in the paper. So I'd need some more convincing that there is actually, if we have to go through this double impairment test, that there is actually some informational benefit in so doing. And right now, my gut feel will be the simplest thing to do will be to take it out of the IFRS 9 impairment model. That's, I think, going to be closest to the status quo under IAS 28 in combination with IAS 39. Then there's still that bit about fixing how you recognise interest income when you actually recognise an impairment, but that would seem to be the most appropriate way to go. But either way, I'd warm to the idea of two impairment tests.
Reinhardt?
My comments are very similar to those of John and Andrew's, in the sense that on the one hand, I do understand how as the staff points out, IFRS 9 would apply given it's a financial liability. But I think, as you know, Sandy and Yong-Soo have said, we're talking about an investment in an associate, and this liability is part of the net investment in that associate, and it's treated like equity for many purposes. It's treated like equity for purposes of absorbing losses. It's treated like equity to the extent it's a foreign exchange denominated, that the currency adjustments go through OCI. And so on balance, I would be say view D is probably the more practical approach in that sense, and perhaps in keeping with it being treated differently from your other financial liabilities for purposes of IAS 28, IAS 21. I think the staff suggestion in terms of how to deal with additional impairment losses on the long-term interest, treating that as a valuation allowance, and then continuing with the effective interest rate. I mean, that's a practical way of dealing with it, but I would be supportive of going down that route.
Martin?
Conceptually, I'm able to follow the staff here, and I would come to the same conclusion. It does not necessarily mean that from a practical perspective, I would say that is the most appropriate approach. On the other hand, what we have to consider is that, according to my mind, we said that we want to collect all issues with regard to the equity method and have a kind of omnibus amendment then. So this topic here, we really have to defend that it is of utmost importance, so that we keep it as a separate issue and decide about it.
Pablo and then Philippe.
In fact, my concerns are very similar to what Sandy said before. I agree with her that there's an implicit assumption in IS 28 that these long-term investments are equity-like instruments, and if that is the case, there's a point in treating them alongside the remaining components of the net investment in terms of determining the impairment and the allocation of losses. However, I also agree with her, with Sandy, in the fact that contractually we cannot be that certain about the assumption. So a possible way of determining whether in fact these instruments are able to or are loss absorbing instruments the same way as or pari passu to equity would be to determine what happens contractually in case of insolvency. So if insolvency, even in case of insolvency, these instruments are going to absorb losses in the same way, exactly the same way as equity instruments, well, then there's a case to treat them as equity and therefore to apply IAS 28 with no intervention of IFRS 9 whatsoever, because they would be exactly the same as the remaining components of the net investment. However, if in case of insolvency, these instruments are ranked senior to equity, then I would see no point in applying IAS 28. Maybe in that case, we should only apply IFRS 9 requirements in terms of impairment, and there would be no need to incorporate these instruments alongside the remaining components of the net investment.
Philippe?
I think Pablo has said more or less what I wanted to say. I think the problem is that we treat all such loans as being the same, but there may be very different circumstances. They may be very near equity, maybe subordinated to a certain extent, and sometimes they are just pure ordinary loans, like any other creditor for that associate. And we have a big range of possibilities, and maybe one size doesn't fit all situations. And I would see sometimes that the loss absorption element is very important, sometimes less. Sometimes just the losses are just an indicator of future losses and should create, should trigger an expected loss approach, expected credit losses, or sometimes just say, no, just absorb the existing losses, incurred losses. And so I think that, I'm not against a SAF proposal, but I think it just doesn't really go far enough to really look at the economic situation.
I think today we are facing a situation where IAS 28 says something and IFRS 9 says something else, so there is something to fix, and I think it can be in the omnibus amendment or it can be something else, but it cannot wait for what exactly is equity and a sort of research, fundamental research on what is equity, otherwise we'll be in a very long time we have the answer on this one. And I think maybe we should work more on what is exactly in the net investment, because I think there's a lot of diversity in practice on that as well, and maybe the answer would depend on what exactly is often in this net investment, but something needs to be done.
John?
I mean, I think there are issues with what's in the net investment, but I think that's not something that we, with the equity method project going on, it seems like it's not something we should be touching. In practice, in my experience, the way the losses are absorbed is they're absorbed in the basis of the liquidation order. So in other words, the ordinary share, your investment in ordinary shares will absorb losses first, and you won't absorb losses into any type of long-term interest until you get to that point in the negative, until the equity, you know, you get to negative equity that absorbs into the different layers. So it's not just all, it's not, in my experience, all tipped into a bucket and absorbs losses equally. It absorbs losses in order of the contractual provisions of the instruments, in my experience. I think the issue about what's in the net interest in net investment, I think, is pretty critical. But I think if we assume for the moment that we're not going to touch that and we're just going to say that this is validly part of the net investment, it seems to me that that unit applying different measurement impairment requirements to one piece of that and then putting absorption of losses. I mean, if you do an expected credit loss on the long-term interest and then you're going to absorb losses, it seems to me the number you're ending up with is nonsense. Now, equity method probably is, people might say that number is nonsense in any event, so I'm not a defender of equity method accounting, but I think to keep it somewhat consistent, it seems to me to put an expected credit loss model there and a loss absorption and an IAS 28 impairment model on top of that ends up with something that doesn't mean anything at all.
Mikhail?
Yes, I think I more or less share that fully, but it would be preferable to have one standard for one thing, so to speak, and my understanding is that we have in substance come to a conclusion that this is a long-term interest which being similar to the equity. So I would support the UB from last time, the UC, that it's only in IS 28 and that should not be an additional impairment test done from IFRS 9 perspective.
Tony?
I guess I was probably comfortable with where the staff ended up. I understand the tensions, but where I guess I begin to struggle with it is we keep talking about what it is, but if it meets the definition of a financial instrument, then I struggle with not applying the guidance for financial instruments to it. We have a particular construct in the equity method, produces numbers that are meaningless regardless of whether you get into this bit, but that's a story for another day. I just see that this seems to be a financial asset, so I would apply the financial asset accounting to it, because I'm not sure what I do with it if, particularly I think there was a point Andrew made last time, how do I recognise interest subsequently if I haven't applied the IFRS 9 impairment model? And I think what the staff have proposed is a simpler answer to addressing that question, which is apply IFRS 9 to the financial asset, and then because IAS 28 tells me to do this curious, let's present them together for the purpose of absorbing share of losses and so on, that I get into that model. But I would share, I think Bruce and Bob said the same thing, let's just work through the mechanics of it. But I think it's the simplest way of doing it, and it sort of preserves the integrity of the IFRS 9 model.
Just not to belabor what
may seem obvious, if there isn't a loss-making entity, this issue doesn't come up.
Yep.
It stays in IFRS 9. It lives happily in IFRS 9. So it's only, with the possible exception, I hadn't tumbled to the foreign currency piece, Reinhardt, only when we run into this nether twilight zone kind of an area here that it would, we would even entertain the thought that it wasn't an IFRS 9. Sandy?
It's not even IAS 28 that's creating the problem. It's the decision about net investment to bring them together that's the problem. That's why I don't see it as an equity method problem per se. I see it as a decision to take them and look at them together. I don't think the instrument shouldn't be looked at in accordance with IFRS 9. I think the issue is that, you know, if you're at equity method and you get to zero, zero is zero under IFRS 9 and under IAS 28, right? So I don't think it's an equity method issue. And my issue is we've got this other thing because of a decision we've taken, and we don't even know if the entity has the obligation to absorb those losses. So I get to, well, we've got a question we've got to solve. Maybe not, right? We've got a question we've got to solve because we've taken an accounting decision that we must aggregate these, but we don't necessarily have an economic decision. So we're looking to book something that may not actually, I think the second step to the question is, okay, we make this allocation, but then is there a legal obligation for this entity to absorb that? If the answer is no, you don't book any other impairment. That's my problem, because we're looking to book a credit that may not belong in the financial statement.
So that's probably the challenge with that is that it's a more fundamental question around the way IAS 28 works than I think we can address at this time.
I don't necessarily disagree with it, but then we're saying we've got to solve it. I agree with that statement, but we're saying we've got to solve it, and I'm not certain that we have an economic problem, we have an accounting problem, and we're looking for comparability, which may be unnecessary, right? That's my problem. We're saying we've got to solve this because we've said this must overlap with this.
But my concern is we have something which I think is pressing, that I think most of us agree with. It's pressing and it needs a fix. And we sort of have to deal with that without dealing with the underlying model in IS 28, which I agree is not necessarily a satisfactory place.
But you're saying it's pressing that we need to fix it because
there's
what the standard says, not because of what's happening economically. So is it pressing to fix?
Oh, because of what's happening in practice, that people are doing different things. And I think that's the concern that Maria was talking about.
But I guess for the users of the financial statements, the question is, so everybody's coming up with a meaningless number. Let's get a more meaningless number one. Or let's get a consistently meaningless number.
Let's all get the same meaningless number.
Consistently meaningless, right? So I think this is a great example of accounting complexity.
Well, but accounting complexity is our business.
Exactly.
But to Wayne's point, in most cases, the effect of what the staff would propose would be to confirm to people you need to apply the IFRS 9 impairment model.
Yeah.
In most cases, that would be the only consequence. It's only in the, and I know it's relevant, but only in the smaller subset of those with losses that you'd get the concern that you're raising. I think Bonnie's been putting her hand up for a while.
Yeah.
Bonnie?
Yeah, I have. So I think, from my perspective, the crux of the issue is that the net investment, these long-term interests are included in the net investment as required, as IAS 28 is currently worded. Instead of looking at what's the underlying nature of the instrument, if it's more like equity, then it probably does make sense that it's included in the net investment and subject to the impairment models within IAS 28. If it's more akin to a financial instrument, then to me it would not be included in the net investment and would be accounted for under IFRS 9 as a financial instrument. So to me, I don't think we can address this issue without addressing the crux of the issue, which is, regardless of the nature, to what Sandy's saying, what's the contractual obligations around these long-term interests, and do they belong in the net investment or do they not belong in the net investment? And I think that was my comment in the last meeting, that it seems like we're artificially shoving these things into the net investment, whether or not they actually belong there based on their contractual nature.
Okay. Let me ask the question this way. We have a staff proposal in front of us, which is found, if I can make my machine work here, paragraph 55,
right place to look?
61 is better.
61, summary, okay. Cleverly, I highlighted when I read the paper. On the basis of your first preference, how many would support this staff recommendation?
One, two, three, four, five, six. Six.
Six. Okay. On the basis of your first preference, so you don't get to vote again now, those of you who voted before, how many are still on the view D?
One, two, three, four.
Four. And Sandy doesn't like any of them.
I'd be fine with us just saying we reconfirm that the financial instrument is accounted for in accordance with IFRS 9 and leave the other questions unanswered.
Okay. How many would object to the staff recommendation?
Three. Four, five, six, seven.
That's too many. Okay. I've run out of options. Anybody got a cunning plan? Mm-hmm. Other than the David Tweedy, let's do away with the equity method forever and ever. Didn't work out so well for David. Probably not going to work out well for us. Michael, you got a cunning plan?
I'm struggling here. I mean, obviously, we should be reporting back to the board the conclusions, or the discussions, rather, that we've had here. The board does have the equity method project on its agenda, but I suppose one of the things that we heard as a concern raised by some was the timeliness of this particular issue. given that IFRS 9 will be coming into effect in the relatively near future, and we wanted to see this existing diversity in practice addressed in time for that coming into effect.
Okay, let me cycle back to something Sandy said. We can say that when you have a financial instrument, the place you start out doing the accounting is the financial instrument's standard. We can say that much. And that is your jumping off point. You don't automatically refer to any other standard until you hit loss recognition.
Yep.
Pardon me?
What Sandy said was slightly different, because she said you confirmed that all of the requirements of IFRS 9 applied if it was a financial instrument, right? Because one of the first questions we had was, what did the scope paragraph in IFRS 9 mean? Because it talks about things being scoped out if 28 applies to them. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing,
okay.
If the intention was to make it clear that the impairment requirements in 9 apply and not then to talk more about the interaction, I think we'd need to make that more clear.
Also, the impairment measurement under 28 could apply before you've got loss making in the associate. We also have
Philippe?
Yeah, if we follow the approach in 9 regarding classification before we apply the impairment model, is it possible to say that the business model or the business activity for the receivables might not fit exactly the three existing categories? This is why maybe they've been scoped out, because it's a different way. You manage a financial asset, which is part of your long-term interest in an associate, maybe on a different business model than the existing ones described in IFRS 9. Or
the way 9 works is, if you're in scope, you have to go into one of the business models. And if you can't positively be amortized cost or fair value OCI, there's a residual business model that captures
point,
everything else.
Yeah, my point is that maybe we scoped out 28, those loans from receivables from 9, because they don't fit well in the existing business models we have defined. But if I had to say, let's put them back into IFRS 9, then the question would be, what kind of business model is it?
I think the reason why the scope paragraph in 9 exists is because it's to make it clear that if you hold equity investments,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But have significant influence, you go to 28, right. Not for any more other purpose.
That would have been my understanding. Well, the chair and the staff are clueless.
So we're open to suggestions as to how we take this. Do we just report back to the board? Is that all we need to do? John?
Yeah. I mean, there was 4 views in the submission. I mean, there were views that it was wholly within 9, there were views that it was wholly within 28, and then there were views that you were in both standards, and to what extent were you in both standards. I mean, I suppose one possibility is ruling out some of the 4 options and therefore reducing diversity from 4 to 2 if we're not able to proceed with an agreement on view B or view D. It seems like you could decide whether view A and view C were should be ruled out.
I guess the
this is going to sound more pejorative than I mean it. To a degree, were those views included for purposes of completeness?
Those views have been used in practice.
Have they all been used in practice? Okay. Andrew?
Yes, as I said earlier, I think the most pressing implementation question for companies is whether or not the IFRS 9 impairment requirements are going to apply, and those who commented around the table, I think, are saying right now, as the current literature stands, they do. So that's how it is right now. We've been talking about how we want it to be if we make certain amendments, but at least I think we could probably clarify what we think the scope paragraph means right now, perhaps through an agenda decision.
Just sort of what Sandy started.
I think I'd be comfortable with that.
That's where Sandy started.
Where Sandy started, I'd be comfortable with that as well.
John, and then we're going to take a break for lunch.
I don't think there's agreement that it does apply. I think people think that the more specific requirements in IAS 28 override the general requirements for financial instruments in IFRS 9. That's exactly why some people subscribe to VUD.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what the staff paper last time suggested.
Right.
Don't agree, we don't agree, but we agree, we don't agree.
Maybe that's the answer. I mean, the answer is exactly what was said. We just come out and we simply say we've looked at the four views. Maybe we say very clearly A and C we do not believe are sustainable. On the other two, at this stage, the standards are not clear. And until the question of equity accounting has been addressed at this stage, use your judgment as to what you think is best and use whichever one you think is there. I mean, is that the wrong answer? If we're saying that we, around this table, we cannot get consensus between the two, I think what we're accepting is we're all accepting that both views are valid. And if that's where we are right now, that's who we are. I mean,
that
Sue and Bonnie, did you want to come in?
My concern is that might increase diversity and sort of bless alternatives that we might not have been too keen on. So maybe that's where we get to.
Yeah.
But I wonder whether the interim step should be to report back to the board, ask the board if they had clarity in terms of intent, and maybe get some direction from the board of what they expected the outcome was, and then decide what the next step should be. Which you might then conclude, well, you can't get there clearly, so we need to make an amendment, but then at least we'd have some clarity of direction.
That would be a better first step. Yeah.
So we're asking the board for a flowchart.
Yeah.
Do this step first, then do that step. Which is essentially what this issue is. It's a flowchart.
Yeah.
Bonnie, did you want to come in?
I agree with Sue. I think I still go back to, in the absence of clarifying in IS 28 what should or should not be included in the net investment, looking at the nature of the underlying instrument as to whether it's financial instruments, therefore subject to IFRS 9, or quasi-equity, and therefore subject to IS 28, I think Sue's suggestion is a good step forward.
Okay. Given the context that this discussion took place in a public meeting, I think we need to take this to a public board meeting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, agreed. Rather than informal consultations. All right. That's what we'll do.